Hi, welcome to Cohen Esri Apartment Investors Podcast, where we talk about various topics in the apartment investing sector. Today we have Lee Harris, who is our President and Chief Executive Officer, and Ryan Huffman, our Chief Operating Officer. My name is Lydia Kincaid, and I manage our market rate funds for Cohen Esri. Today we are going to give sort of a mid-year report. We're in July of 2023, and so we're about halfway through the year. We have some data on some trends that we're seeing. What's going on in the market, what's going on with residents, because you see a lot of headlines out there. We've talked about that on prior podcasts as well, but we thought now would be a good time to really give you a good feel for what's happening right here in the middle of the year. So how about, Lee, you and I were talking about some newer data that's come out in terms of generational trends with home buying. And for our audience, in the past, first-time home buying used to be a big competitor for Class B, for the Class B multifamily space. That was something that could draw people away from renting. But we're seeing quite a shift, and even in preferences, as well as just ability to buy homes. So Lee, how about you talk us through some of these trends that we've seen?
The generational trends have been out there for a while. We've talked about them for the last several years, and that's one of the reasons that we are so bullish on the Class B apartment market. The latest statistics that we've seen really bolster the case. There's some new survey data from Apartment List, which is an entity that tracks apartments in a lot of respects. They reveal that 24.7% of millennials said they plan to always rent rather than buy a house. Now, my generation, that was what we aspired to, is the American dream, own a home. And as you said before, certainly the competition, the biggest competition in the past for apartments has been the purchase of a single family home. However, that is changing very quickly. Actually, it's changing. 74% of the respondents said they cannot afford to buy a home right now. 42% said they like flexibility of renting. 36% said they prefer to avoid home maintenance and other extra costs. And 29% believe that buying a home is financially risky. So there's some other factors here, I think, that are at work. Certainly, the average millennial student debt balance is $40,600. 70% of millennials have some form of non-mortgage debt, averaging, get this, $117,000. The Generation Z, we call them Zoomers, had more than $16,000 in debt at the end of 2022. That was an increase of 3%. And they have $20,900 in student debt. Now, why is it less than the millennials? Because a lot of the Zoomers still are in college. And so there's a large cohort of that generation that is still accumulating that debt. Further, the median home price in 2019 was $322,000. The median home price in 2022 had risen to $458,000. And interestingly, also, the average housing supply between 1982 and 2023 was 2.3 million units, housing units of whatever sort, rental or ownership. Average housing supply in April of 2023 is 1 million. So it's constricted considerably here. Just a few more statistics, and then we'll unpack this. The Zillow Home Value Index, which measures only that middle price tier of homes, showed a typical cost of $344,141. Now, that would require a down payment of $34,000 and a $310,000 loan at 8.122% on a fixed rate basis for 30 years, with a monthly payment of $2,296. And if you use that median home price of $458,000, that would require a down payment of $46,000 and a $412,000 loan at that same 8.122% fixed rate for 30 years, or a monthly payment of $3,044. So what does all this mean? This means that we have really two generations here, the Zoomers and the Millennials, that many of them, there's just no way in the foreseeable future they can ever afford to buy a home. They can't afford the down payment. They can't afford the monthly payments. They have the debt issue hanging over their head, which causes credit score issues. And what does that mean for the apartment industry? It looks like we're going to have a lot of demand for apartments for a long time to come.
Lee, thanks for those statistics. I think it's really telling, and no surprises, except I think in the volume of like how much debt people have, that's really quite shocking to see those numbers continuously increasing, especially related to these generational trends. Ryan, maybe you could share with our audience what absorption has been looking like. If demand is so high for these apartments, what are we seeing? Maybe start here in Kansas City. What's absorption look like? And we can talk about another one of our target markets as well, maybe either Atlanta or Memphis. But what does absorption look like in Kansas City?
Yeah, I mean, Kansas City is interesting. So absorption, we typically deliver between 3,600 and 3,900 units a year here in Kansas City. The five-year average is just a little over 3,900. I think 3,909 a year. Our absorption last year was right around 3,600 of those units. So you are starting to see a bit of a tilt. Now, what's interesting, and I typically use the Colliers reports because I find them to be really, really detailed. We are going to almost double our delivery schedule in 2023. There's forecasted right now under construction for delivery across the metro over 7,100 units scheduled for delivery. And the absorption is scheduled to go down to an annual 1,600. So you are starting to see a bit of a demand supply tilt in this particular market. Now, some of that is being driven by, as you can see in some markets, oversupply. I mean, if you look at this nationally, in 2022, we actually saw contraction in absorption across the country, again, due to deliveries. First quarter of 23, we were back to positive absorption again, almost 19,000 units positive in that quarter. So there is still, as Lee said, high demand. I would caution everybody, it really is market by market. I mean, if you look across the country, overall absorption is positive. There's about 50 markets where absorption is still negative. And I would call it your typical culprits, what you would see kind of if you look at news headlines versus what's here. Your Los Angeleses, your New York cities, those are leading the negative absorption. Chicago, Houston. Interestingly, Dallas is on that list, and that's largely because of how much construction they have going on in Dallas. But I think that'll all absorb. Riverside, California, those areas are seeing the negative absorption. But you get to areas like, you know, where we are, like Northport, Florida, where there's positive absorption. And in other areas of Texas, there's positive absorption. So the areas where you're seeing population migration, Florida, Texas, are still seeing those really positive absorption figures. So I do agree. I think the data supports high demand for apartments continues. And I think as pricing stabilizes, which we can talk about in a little bit, you'll continue to see positive absorption take hold.
So maybe you can unpack this a little bit. If demand is so high, are the markets that you're saying maybe have some negative absorption, is that because the population growth just isn't there? It's in these other areas that are seeing a higher absorption? Or what's your read between the lines there?
I mean, the read between the lines, if you look at, I'm going to say it's population migration. So what you have, if you look at the statistics, New York, California, you're seeing population declines there. We could get into, and Lee, you'll laugh, because we could get into a number of reasons why that might be. Some of it largely is tax related. Some of it may be politically related. Pick whatever you want, but there's a great deal of population migration moving. Areas like Florida, Texas are seeing huge bumps in population growth where folks are migrating to those areas. So it's very natural that you're seeing those high-priced markets, San Francisco, New York, LA, where the rent's just gone bonkers, and now the taxation rates are going up higher. All of a sudden, people are migrating to lower cost of living in better climates. That's my opinion. Lee, you can take over from here and see what you think.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting. I'm looking at some more statistics here. I guess I'm the statistics guy today. But the cities with the highest number of move-ins, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina, was number one. Sarasota, Florida, which is our Northport, Florida, is right in that Sarasota, Bradenton metro. That was number two. Orlando, number three. Ocala, Florida, number four. Houston, five. Dallas, six. Knoxville, Tennessee, seven. Jacksonville, Tampa Bay, Greenville, Spartan, North or South Carolina, Nashville, Tennessee, Melbourne, Florida, and the list goes on. San Antonio, Texas, Boise, Idaho, North Carolina, Arizona, Georgia. All of this is, for the most part, Sun Belt. Portland, Maine is in there, actually, so that's a bit of an anomaly. But you didn't hear anything about a California market. You didn't hear anything about a New York market, an Illinois market, as you point out, even Colorado. We're seeing this mass in-migration in the Sun Belt states, and we're seeing it also in the Midwest. They don't make Midwestern cities don't make this list, at least not in the top 20. But we still know that the Columbuses and Indianapolises and the Kansas Cities of the world are seeing in-migration. So. You're absolutely right on point that it's market by market. There's no question, Lydia.
So also related to this, what's going on with rent growth? We have mentioned some of the headlines. We see that rent growth is tanking and whatnot. But again, Lee, to your point and Ryan as well, the data that we're seeing shows that it's very selective market by market. And perhaps it's the acceleration of rent growth that has slowed down and not just rent growth itself. Ryan, maybe you could comment on that.
I definitely would tell you it's market by market. Because a lot of this, when you look at the overall rent growth, let's just start at the top. Right now, I think in first quarter, the average rent in the U.S. was $1,995. That is down 0.56% from a year ago, but it's up 1.44 month over month. So what I have said all along from a nationwide perspective is you can't have 5-7% rent growth forever. It's going to normalize back out to that 2-3% rent growth. And I think really that's what you're seeing in most markets. If you are in a market that is facing overbuilding, and you know, Dallas would be a good example of this. Dallas is in, I think, in a very blip area where they're delivering a great, huge number of units. The population is migrating there and is needed, but the deliveries are outpacing that for a very short period. They will absorb all of that and be fine. You look at a New York, you look at a San Francisco, you look at an LA, where the population is migrating out, and you may be seeing a contraction there and a bit of a bloodbath on rents for a bit until something logjam breaks there and you get population migration back into those areas. In other words, if it's a very simple supply-demand calculation, if the demand is there from the population where the population is going, you'll see rents go back to a normal 2-3% increase. We are still seeing in the portfolio, you know, 4-5% increase because of where our exposures are here in the Midwest. As with all things, the ripple starts on the coast and ripples in. So I expect us to normalize back out to that 2-3% rent growth.
And Ryan, what are we modeling typically in our underwriting process?
So we're very, very surgical with that. We do not do a blanket increase. What we do is we look at the metadata in Axiometrics. And so Axiometrics is a software that's powered by RealPage, but it gets granular. So what it does is it can forecast out what it thinks a market is going to do quarter by quarter based on performance of the market today. So we use those metrics year by year to go. I would say our average is running 2.5-3% if you average it out over a 5-7 year hold. But it's very surgical year by year. We may start out with, if it's forecasting 5% rent growth, I'll handicap that at a 4. So we've got some runway. Then it may drop to a 3. Then it may drop to a 2 ongoing. It just really depends on what the software shows that forecast looks like.
Mm-hmm. Lee, is there anything you'd like to add in terms of rent growth trends we're seeing?
Yeah, I think interesting statistic from just earlier this month. That in May, the average length of time that a rental unit sat empty fell to 26 days. And that's the shortest duration since August of 2022. This is Marcus & Millichap, which is a large apartment brokerage. They have an apartment brokerage arm that issued that report. They also said that new lease applications per unit increased in the last 2 months, and velocity of lease renewals per unit also grew. So, you know, it's the summertime. It's typically the busy season in the rental market. And again, even with some overbuilding, I don't know if overbuilding is really the right terminology, but increase in supply, let me put it that way. In certain markets, we are still seeing just overall a healthy situation here in terms of rent increases, in terms of days units are it's taking to rent vacant units. We're seeing that increase in lease applications and the renewals. I think lease renewals, Ryan, you might speak to this a little bit too, because that's something all of us as apartment operators strive for, is to increase the number of lease renewals. It's so expensive when a unit turns over, with the painting and the cleaning and the maintenance and days vacant and marketing dollars and everything else. What do you think, the from an industry standpoint, are we seeing more lease renewals and less turnover, or is it flat? Where do we stand right now as an industry?
I think you're seeing, my gut reaction to that is you're seeing an increase in turnover. Now, I think some of that is driven by what I'm going to call the pandemic overhang. I mean, for a couple of years there, you had very low turnover because people just didn't move. They stayed put. Now you've got a strong labor market, but you still got some economic conditions that are causing people to reevaluate their housing situation. Some may be searching for cheaper rent in areas where you've got concessions starting to bleed in. They may take advantage of that. I would say you're seeing an uptick in turnover this year. Will that stabilize out? Probably, I would say, in 24, 25. But I think 23 is kind of that year. Well, 22 is a little bit that way, but 23 is really the year where kind of all of the restrictions have gone away. The government pulled the emergency authorization orders, and now everybody's kind of footloose and fancy free and looking to change up where they're at a little bit more. So I think
Ryan, what in normal times, pre-pandemic, what would average turnover be on an apartment property on an annual basis?
You assume it's around 40%. I would say you're pushing 50-55% on assets right now, probably nationally.
And do you think that will normalize again to that 40% range, or do you think that a lot of the new supply and will that have an impact in terms of generating more turnover?
I think it would have short-term impact. I think long-term, I always say everything reverts back to the mean. So at some, you know, whether it's rents coming down back to the mean, turnover coming down back to the mean, everything will normalize back out to the mean. So I think turnover will normalize back down. I agree with you, Lee. Instead of saying overbuilding, I just say the timing of delivery. I think, you know, if you think development starts, you know, 2, 3, 4 years in advance of delivery, you know, who would have thought rates would have been moving where they were, the economy would have gone 4 years ago to where we are today. So a lot of these projects that are right now coming into lease up, it's just a timing issue. There's a lot of product in a lot of these markets that was just timed to come out at this point, and there's just some economic headwinds that are facing them. I think it all normalizes out over time.
And how about with these next two topics? I think we can talk about them together. Ryan, what are you seeing with cap rates, your favorite topic, as well as interest rates? And what does that combination do to buyers and sellers alike?
I mean, it's definitely challenging. So nationally, the cap rate has climbed to an average 4.72%. That's the average across the nation. It has, what's interesting is the correlation with the Fed hikes. So it's gone up every quarter by about between 30 and 38 bips a quarter. If you look back historically at the last four quarters in terms of cap rate expansion, it definitely is not expanding as quick as interest rates are. I mean, interest rates right now, depending on the product, at the height, they were at 7. So now you're probably hovering in the sixes, anywhere from, call it 6 to 6.5 is what we're modeling. Depending on the loan product, and there's always blips in the product. For example, HUD and FHA have always been the lower interest rates. Well, like a couple of months ago, the government came out with $500,000 Ginnie Mae sale, and the interest rates went up even higher than Fannie Freddie. So there's some anomalies out in the market, but it's definitely making purchasing difficult. And the most difficult part of the purchasing right now is, if you think an average cap rate is 4.72, and you're even if your average debt rate was 6, you've got an inversion there. And that's generally gives everybody the heebie-jeebies because your debt is higher than what your cap rate is. So what's happening then is people are coming out with product, and there's not a lot of product in the market. Volume is down about 42% year over year so far. I think that's going to continue depending on what the Fed does. You know, the anticipation 6 months ago was the Fed would halt their increases July and start reductions. They're now signaling either a hold or maybe two more hikes. Now, today the inflation came out and it cooled again. So there's kind of a mixed bag of data on what the Fed is going to do next, but it really is making purchasing difficult, and pricing is coming down 10 to 20% from what people anticipated getting when they went out on the market. And so it's causing a lot of product to be pulled off the market and people to continue to hold. So there's a lot of headwinds with purchasing right now. You just have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
I would add to that, the Fed is a wild card here, obviously. I happen to believe that they're jawboning with this two more rate increase concept. They may still do it. I remember back, and I'm fuzzy on the time exactly and the amounts, but I think directionally I'm right, and that is in 2000, we were at somewhere around 5.75% on the interest rates. The Fed was jawboning again and talking about more increases, and by June of the following year, rates were down below 2%. This could be the same thing happening. It may not. I don't know. But I think that two more rate increases are not a fait accompli here. I think that there's some posturing that may be going on, and hopefully we'll see at the next Fed meeting that they decide to stay put, especially if this economic data comes out the way it looks like it might. Case in point, the ADP report came out last week on Thursday, I believe, and it showed 450,000 new jobs. The next day, the government report came out, 209,000 jobs. So that's a massive difference. Who's right? I don't know. I do know hospitality picked up a lot of that increase, hotels and cruise lines and restaurants. They've just been so struggling so much for help, and now we're in that summer season where people are traveling, and so there was a lot of hiring that went on there, that some of that seasonal hiring as well. The JOLTS report came out also last week, showing less than 9.8 million job openings. A year ago that was 12 million. Those are positive signs, I think, when we're talking about the Fed and what they may do. Again, I don't know what their black box is supposed to show right now, and they won't share that, but that is the real wild card here. But I think there's some jawboning going on to try to cool the economy even more and create a soft landing. Whether we'll have a recession or not, whether we're actually in a recession, it remains to be seen. Mm-hmm.
Well, how about as our last topic of discussion, what are we seeing in terms of resident preferences today? The biggest part of our investment thesis is that we are delivering the best B product in a certain market. And so we want to make sure that we are delivering what residents want, whether it's amenities inside the unit, outside the unit, their customer experience. Ryan, what are you seeing in terms of what is of highest value to residents who are looking for apartments?
I don't know that that's changed a great deal from what we talked about prior. I mean, I'm still going to say you're looking at the boomers that are coming into the rental market as a renter of choice. You're looking at the Gen Zs that are coming out of college. So you have to compare the housing they've been in to the housing they're entering. And, you know, I always say, I look at college dorms today and it's like the penthouse compared to when I was in college. And it's probably a mansion compared to when we were, They expect a lot. You know, what used to be an amenity like a garbage disposal is now expected. But, you know, when you used to have in unit washer dryer connections, that was an amenity that's now expected. And so they want that community space. I still say dog, anything pet related is a huge gimme, whether it's private pet yards, whether it's dog parks, whatever that case is. A lot of folks have pets and they're very tied to those pets. Interestingly, you know, as the electric car market starts to come up, having those charging stations on property will become an amenity. I wouldn't say it's widespread. We have, I think, two properties that have those stations right now that get used. It's a small percentage because I think the electric car market's like 1% of the total car market. That's going to really, again, be area by area, market by market. I think that's going to become very quickly not an amenity, but a requirement in like California, where it may not be so in like the Kansas City area for a while. So I think the more of those types of amenities you can add are positive. Anything online, anything they can access from their phones through active building announcements, pay rent, all of that's expected at this point, online leasing. So all of that stuff is a plus. Having your pool, having your community center, that's all expected now too. So I think I don't have an answer that's very different from what we had said before. I think there's not a lot of preference changes right now. Lee, what you get that same impression?
I do. And let's unpack the electric vehicle thing a little bit more. The media makes it sound like there's this huge trend toward electric vehicles. And there is a growing trend, but put this in perspective. There are 1.7 million electric cars in operation in the U.S. right now. That's out of 285 million total vehicles on the road. That's 0.6%. The average price for a new electric car this year is $64,000. And the average price for a new car of any kind is $48,000. So again, we talked about the issues that renters have buying homes because of the student debt, because of their non-mortgage debt, because of down payment, et cetera, et cetera. It's pretty tough to figure out how to stroke a check for $64,000 or make the car payments on $64,000 average price for a new electric car. They can buy used cars, of course, but the point is that I think that the EV market is probably a ways off for apartments where there's going to be huge demand for a lot of electric charging stations. Ryan is right about pets. The dog parks, especially what we're doing is beefing those up with all sorts. It's not just a fenced area, but we try to have water. We try to have obstacles that they can run through and over and whatnot, and lighted at night. Dog washes. We've installed several dog washes. That's pretty popular right now. It's not a huge item from a cost standpoint. We've installed car washes. Again, that's something that you see more on Class A product. We're installing them as part of our Best B element. However, one thing that I would point out that's not an amenity, but it's a major factor, we believe, in differentiating, and that is how the customer is treated and how they perceive their community. If it's clean, that's a basic and fundamental. Are there cigarette butts in the curb? Are there weeds in the curb? Are they greeted by the rental staff, the management staff, in a friendly manner? And do people know their names? Basics and fundamentals of providing good customer service still trumps every amenity that you can. I mean, you got to have the amenities. There's no question. But that's the way you cement that relationship, is with the kind of service that you provide. And that's age old. For the last 48 years I've been in the business, that has always been right up there at the top.
And I agree with that. And the one thing I didn't mention, I want to throw it in here at the very end, is package lockers are becoming a gigantic amenity. And that's because of all the online, the Amazon deliveries, all those things. So having those package locker systems on site where they can come home at 6 o'clock after work, punch a code and get their package and not have to wait for the office to be open to get it, huge. So I think that one is one. Again, I think that'll accelerate and become expected a lot faster maybe than other amenities, but right now it's huge amenity. But I agree with the customer being treated correctly too. That's essential.
Well, Ryan, Lee, thank you so much as always for your time today and for all the wisdom you shared with our audience. Thanks everyone for listening.